Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With no due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
Does my shit together,
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Well, I'm up at Jackson Jack. I'm Tom Howell. Ricky on the board. S&P futures up 28, and NASDAQ futures up 180. Just keep moving along here, It's Apple came out. I guess you could call it. We have Kevin.
You do. Good morning.
I guess we could call it a paradox that we're going to come out today with the PCE, which is the Fed's preferred inflation gauge. The reason why it's preferred is because nobody gets to see any detail. Nobody knows what it is. They just wing a number at us. And somehow or other, as a population, we either believe these people or we don't care or we don't realize how much much of crap it is. Anyway, so Apple comes out. Now, we're going to cheer any kind of low number on the inflation. Yet Apple comes out and says they've raised all the prices on their services. Well, they didn't say that. They said their margins have increased, which is the same thing, right, Kevin? And we cheer Apple. Can we be more? We have water on both shoulders here. What would you call it?
Load of crap.
Yeah. I don't. Boy, I spent a lot of time yesterday going through all the tapes and stuff on that plane crash. Pretty awful, eh?
Yeah, it is, and I did not spend a lot of time on it, and I know Carl did too, so you guys will probably have some good conversation. I do think there's a lot of, let me put it this way, for my part, I just want to I want to let it unfold. I don't really have a comment about any of the causes or any of that, because I don't know enough on the flight stuff. You know, I thought your conversation with Lou was very informative yesterday, but that's what I know. The rest is, you know, there's a whole lot of political stuff mushrooming up from it, and I'm not interested in hearing it until they have some real answers.
What can't people stop that? Which is the way we are now?
It is the way we are. It's an unfortunate thing that it's the way we are. Some of it may be true and evident and so on, but, you know, I think a good rule is to at least take 3 or 4 days and shut up.
I don't see how there could be any kind of politics even involved in this, and yet somehow there is. One side's accusing the other. Of course, you know, for the president to come out and start talking about how people are being hired by the FAA that are mentally deranged or mentally incapable or something, what does that say to you if you're some guy sitting in your hair tower and you hear that doing your job?
What did I tell you about firefighting? You know, do I care? You know, what do I care the most about? I want the most competent people involved, let's just let it go there, and then we'll see where the rest of it is just stupid stuff. It's people catering to constituencies, and unfortunately, or maybe it's more fortunate. Maybe the most fortunate thing about the most recent shift in political tastes is that people are starting to reject some of the ideological stuff in favor of common sense.
It's a different ideological stuff. We're just changing in some ways. We knew a couple of guys that were traffic control.
You hang with all the wrong people, so you get a very, very, you're exposed to a weird sample.
The sample keeps getting bigger, but You know, and when we were younger, we had several friends of ours that were air traffic controllers. And you had to be sort of the best of the best to get to O'Hare Tower or Aurora Center. And I'm going to put Reagan right in there. That's got to be one of the toughest jobs. I can't believe that people there are not the best of the best. I mean, that would be crazy, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of visual places you could go if you weren't one of the, you know, the top dog. I'm not saying you weren't good at what you did, but there's visual places people go. There's more quieter airports. I don't think that the person who's at South Bend Airport is ready to go tomorrow to O'Hare or National, do you? I mean, maybe on paper, but I think that's a much more experienced spot for somebody. What I didn't find, Kevin, on all the tapes, and you keep always seeing it crash 100 times, it's eerie. What I didn't see on all the tapes is why did they send the guy at the last minute to the other runway? I didn't hear any explanation of that, did you?
No.
Cause that,
no. For those there's lots of reasons they do that. That you know,
wind.
Well, it might have been wind, yeah. It could have been wind.
It was wind. They were in the process of transitioning traffic onto 33.
Yeah, so wind shifting, yes. So that would be one. That would be congestion at one or another. You know, there's lots of reasons they could do it.
Yeah, so they sort of go in the right same direction, though. They're off a little bit, but it's not like one's, you know, totally cross the other one. One's at a little bit of an angle. But anyway, well, depending on the other one, they're both at an angle, right? But anyway, it's sad to see in the people who are working in the water with the ice and all the other stuff. Man, what a bad night that is, huh? Pulling out bodies. And I can't imagine people do stuff like that. I mean, what do they think of the rest of their life when they remember that night? But yeah, I pulled out five bodies. Well, that's great. I mean, and by the way, you got frostbite and everything else on top of it. Kind of, I don't think you're gonna forget that one for a while, are you?
Well, probably not.
Just all right. So we're gonna talk about something different. We have earnings came out, and some of the stuff which I think is sort of interesting. The Tesla, it was down huge when their earnings first came out. Then they popped way up, and now there's some. This is weird because I actually checked this out with a professional accountant yesterday, which I am not, a tax guy. And they're allowing Tesla to have essentially, I think this is right, your Bitcoin investments essentially can be on two sets of books now. You can mark them to market, it appears. So Tesla has a bunch of Bitcoin that they bought cheaper and it's worth a lot of money. So they were able to take a $600 million profit, it appears, because their car sales are for shtunkin. They took the $600 million profit on the Bitcoin, but they don't pay taxes on it. Which, now if most of the people listening to the show have trading accounts, I would assume. Now if you're a retail trader, you pay taxes when you sell the stock, okay? Or if you short it first when you buy it back, but most people don't do that. So if you have, you know, IBM at $50 and it was up $30 yesterday and it's trading $257, you're not paying tax on it, even though you've got a $207 gain in there. Now if you're a professional trader, the Tax Act of 1984, if it was me when I was still on the trading floor and I owned a bunch of IBM and it was up $100, I have to pay taxes on the increase. I pay taxes on my, essentially, my portfolio at the beginning of the year. My portfolio at the end of the year, minus any cash coming in or out, and that I have to pay taxes on that. So you have to mark yourself to market. Now retail people don't. So they're selling, what they're saying to Tesla, maybe this is what the $1 million bought. I don't know. What they're saying to Tesla is you get to tell everybody that you're up $600 million. Who knows? Maybe even pay bonuses on it, or you do whatever you want. I guess on the bonuses, but you don't pay taxes till you actually sell it, which, you know, is. Sort of like a retail trader, I guess, but it's a little bit odd, don't you think, Kevin? I mean, just saying, but it's just different. I just explained that I'm not making an opinion one way or the other. So, but for them to say they're up to $600 million and don't worry about them having to pay taxes on it because they don't have to. I guess that's the the whole part of the story. He's not making an opinion one way or the other, because they probably aren't professional traders. But it's interesting, isn't it?
You know, I think so, yeah.
When normally you don't see firms, and there's been some takeovers in my lifetime in the business. If O'Neill Enterprises 40 years ago bought, you know, a hunk of farmland somewhere and has been leasing it out for 50 years, and all of a sudden O'Neill Enterprises isn't doing so hot, you don't normally publish in your earnings report, oh, by the way, my farmland is worth a hell of a lot more. You don't normally do that. I mean, it's probably on your balance sheet. If somebody were to look into it deeply, like our late friend Bob Golden, he could tell us where it was. But companies normally don't do that. I mean, whether they should or they shouldn't, I don't know. But you don't normally see that. But if somebody owns a square block in Manhattan, they don't say, oh, by the way, we just figured out the square block in Manhattan is now worth $1 billion, and we paid $50,000 for it in 1910. You don't see people popping up with that and calling it income, necessarily. But, you know, it's a change, I guess, and people allow people with the Bitcoin to do that. So, I don't know what you think of that. It just is, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of where it is, you know. So
there.
I don't really have anything to add to that. So.
No, you would have bet that, what's his name, proposes to, what's her name, after the Super Bowl? 12% chance. So you bet $100 and he proposes, you win $750.
Okay, so that's if he proposes. Can you bet on the answer? Can you double up and bet on the answer?
I don't know. You think she's going to say no? Maybe. We never know.
I don't know. Doesn't Taylor Swift make a living on songs about men done her wrong?
Yeah, well, you know. A lot of people sing the blues. They still get married, right?
They sing the blues because they get married.
that's very possible. Hey, one of the ladies who worked here in the office for a while with one of the groups that I was doing some business with, terrific lady, very, very attractive. By the way, she's a tall girl, I mean, was a swimmer, and she met her now fiancé on tall match. Apparently, there's a tall match. There's matches for everybody.
Oh, yeah. There's an everything, Tom.
Well, yeah, and I don't know this.
I have no doubt that they are all, you know, run on the same database. It's just, you know, they just change the queries to match people up.
But you know, me being the knucklehead that I am, and I met the guy. He's a great guy. So I mean, it's one of those really good things, I think. But her mom sells rings, and I've actually, some of the people I knew were getting married, I kind of maneuver over to her mom, and she's from Wisconsin, and she sells engagement rings on the side. So, well, they're sort of, she goes, yeah, well, you know, he proposed, and I go, oh, are you excited? Oh, yeah. I said, you know, how excited can you be when you knew he was shopping the ring with your mom? I guess it's still exciting. I don't know. It's just kind of weird. It's not out of the blue, is it?
Hey, if he gets a good deal, that's worth it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a beautiful ring. And you know, like I said, it's a great couple, so I'm real happy that I became friends with them. So, but yeah, I'm saying, I guess, well, Manny Rubber, when he proposed, he did it in New York. She knew it was coming, but she didn't know it was coming there. So I guess he did a good job. Anyway, just trying to talk about some good stuff here this morning a little bit. Although the market, Kevin, our clients have kind of never done better than we have the last few weeks. Now, everybody knows I've been kind of long these metals for a while because I don't like what's happened to the dollar. And, you know, I was a little early, but now all of a sudden this week, boy, yesterday was the biggest day we ever had in there. And, you know, we had extra stuff and we had the metals themselves. Now, today they're kind of flat. But somebody's pouring money into the system. Somebody's lying to us about the inflation. And, you know, I listen to Paul. Kevin, is he even remotely in charge, or is he just totally a figurehead? He talks like he doesn't know what's going on. They've been goosing the money supply now for 6 months, since last July. And he keeps tossing these inflation. Well, we maybe it could be 2.5. We could be 2. We see it. Kevin, they're doing it on a daily basis, and he doesn't even. Nobody asks the right questions. What are we doing? I mean, you'd swear we were in a horrible economy and they were trying to inflate the place by their actions. You know, everyone was talking about how great the labor numbers are and everything else. Have we totally gone with this you know, two different economies where the people that own assets are going to so outdistance other people that in 5 years you're not going to recognize the place. But you don't recognize it now compared to where it was 20 years ago in terms of distribution.
Yeah, well, a certain amount of that's normal.
A little bit. But it's a, I don't know, Kevin. I guess you have to be observant on the subject, you know, since I've been in college and I've been studying economics. I've never seen the total change like this, where all your wealth, virtually all your wealth, comes from asset ownership to the detriment of people who are not asset owners. And the real wealth, when's, other than your, you know, somebody who happens to land on top of a big corporation or one of these big hospitals or something, how many people do you know can gain real wealth by just working, even if they have a really good job? I mean, what's a really good job? 150 a year, 175, 200? You would think that's a lot. You don't gain wealth like that. You're not going to end up with, you know, $50 million in wealth by that, because if you got a family and a nice house and a couple of cars, you're pissing that away pretty quick, aren't you?
Well, it is easy to go through it, but I suppose, you know, if you are one of those stories of people who, people who, you know, come from nothing and they become CEO of a major corporation, I suppose you can make a lot of wealth, you know, but that's rare.
Yeah, I'm saying there's 500 of those guys, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it is. To have the kind of wealth that you people think of being wealthy, it's incredibly difficult to do it just by, you know, and you can't really gain. I mean, how many people, the people you teach, the people you know, how many people can put away 20% of their paycheck? Like our parents used to do all the time. They didn't make that much, but very few.
My educational mission for most of my students, let me put it this way, there's kind of two of them, and then some of them will go on to big success. We just had a young woman who's doing really, really well now, and this goes back to when I first started teaching full time. She was our distinguished graduate, which is sort of the Ivy Tech equivalent of the what do they call the person who always speaks at graduation? The
valedictorian.
Valedictorian, yeah. So
you would remember that if you were one.
Yes, I would. I'd be and I would be saying it at least once a week. She just got appointed to the our board of trustees. So you know, she's kind of getting up there and getting some influence. And I think that's great. You know, we used to joke with her because I had her in her last semester, and we said, "I'm going to fail you just because we want to keep you around." we do have those, but most of my stories are I get a lot of people who come from, from families whose income is below the poverty line. So I'm just trying to get those people. You know, they don't have great high school educations. We have to do a lot of foundational work with them just to get them to succeed in their classes. We want to teach them the skills they need to get good middle class jobs, so that they aren't trying to, you know, that they aren't struggling all their lives. But although middle class jobs nowadays, I guess you are struggling anyway. To get people into where they have good solid skills, and then if they get to a point at some point where they want to, they can keep going, and that might not be until you're 30, 31, 32, you know, whatever age group you're talking about there, then come on back, let's get you, you know, let's start working on getting you a bachelor's degree and getting you the credentials you need to move up. But that's, you know, that's one group. The other group is I get a whole lot of people who have been working in, you know, good jobs, solid jobs, manufacturing, warehouses, things like that. But, you know, they're getting up there and they're tired of doing all the physical labor and they want to develop the skills they need to move into the offices. Same businesses, you know, still manufacturing, but they don't want to be working the line anymore. So, you know, I get that group too.
Well, that's
most of my population. I get some. I get the computer science majors who are coming in. they're just making a good economic decision for their first 2 years, and then they want to go to IU or someplace like that and finish the program. But that's not most.
Well, that's a, you know, you guys, I mean, I don't know if you're listening on Wednesday, I was talking to Russell. The ease with which people move from the, you know, junior college, regional college, to the major universities in Indiana. I don't know why Illinois is so behind in that. Or what about the other states? What about like Ohio and Wisconsin? Are they more like you or more like Illinois?
Don't know. That's a good question, and I don't know the answer. You know, Indiana has a core that if you do that, you will get accepted. You will move. Every community college has a series of articulation agreements, and we have some of those with the private schools. So, for instance, Bethel University is in our area, Goshen College, places like that. But, you know, Franklin University, we have them. We have an articulation agreement for supply chain with Purdue, but it's very engineering-oriented. Speaking of Purdue, I happen to be talking to you from Lafayette today.
Really?
So I'll be on our campus here in Lafayette. The ones, you know, our Bloomington campus has a great relationship with Indiana University directly. We have a good relationship here in Lafayette with Purdue. I think a lot of that helps to have one big statewide community college, and sometimes that is very frustrating because, you know, I often say I work for the government, and sometimes that's painfully obvious.
Yeah.
But on the other, the state legislature, I mean, we have all the, you know, early childhood and, you know, majors like that where you're not going to make a ton of money, but they're very, very focused on throughout the education system trying to bolster the kinds of jobs that they want for the kinds of industries they want to attract. So, if construction, yeah, that's construction's part of it, but logistics and supply chain, business, information technology, healthcare related stuff, that's all in the focus areas for the school, the priorities for the school. And that's our priority to feed the state either with employees directly or with students who are going to continue those studies and get a bachelor's degree. And that's policy. You know, that's how funding gets done in the state of Indiana.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. These numbers, Kevin, I'm looking at these, I don't know what I expected. I tried to people are making over $150,000 a year, but it didn't come up with that. It came up with people over 100,000, and these numbers are startling to me. You know, I'm talking about, like, I know what I'm talking about. I pull them out, and amazing how numbers can change your mind, right? Now, keep in mind that in the year 2007, there was an article here, I think I still have it, talking about how the people who, when the houses were $235,000, that you needed $85,000 a year. If somebody gave you the $47,000 down payment, you needed $85,000 a year as a person. Now, granted, I'm going to get into the part about the family wealth now, but you need $85,000 a year to qualify for that mortgage after insurance, after all that other stuff. So now the median house price is $406,000. So let's say now the person is up a tax bracket, you know, so that makes it harder. But let's just go to straight numbers and not complicate this too much, like maybe we should. So if you just extrapolate, Kevin, where does that put you? You're up roughly 50% on the house, maybe 60, right? So you really need, what, 150 to buy that house. Now we're forgetting the part about the insurance is more and the taxes are more. Let's leave that alone. Let's keep this simple at this hour in the morning. So a person has to make 150 to afford the median house. And I'm looking here. This is people making over $100,000. In the 18 to 24 age group, 7% of the people do. 25 to 34, 18% of the people. That's not very much. 35 to 44. This is surprising, Kevin. I'm going to say you're going to be shocked here. 35 to 44, 25% of the people make 100,000. 45 to 54, which I would think would be your prime.
Lost
age.
You for a minute there. What were you? Say that again.
But from 35 to 44, 25% of the people make over 100,000 bucks. But this is stunning to me. 45 to 54, which normally is the spot where you finally make the vice president or something something. It goes down. It's only 20% of the people in this age group earn over 100 grand. And get a little list. 55 and older, only 16% make 100 grand. I'm kind of stunned at these numbers, aren't you?
Not really.
Well, I'd say you better read this than I do, right? I would have thought that the 45 to 54 made more than 35 to 44.
You start a decline at some point. That seems to be a little bit early for that. But this is, you know, this is sort of what we know about income levels, is people move up for a while and then they begin to move out of that into lower income levels. The problem with that, and you're going to see this, you know, is it, we already are seeing it, is that, how do I want to say it? Is that people can't afford to ratchet down, so instead they're going to be working longer.
Well, now if you want to look at the houses, now the first thing everybody's going to say is, Chief, what the hell are you doing? Everybody's got two incomes now. Okay. 25% of men are over 100,000, 12% of women over 100,000. Now, but the part about the second income, that's not a free gain, is it? I mean, if two people work and you own a house, I'm going to say, if you have a family, I'm going to say you have child care. I'm going to say you probably have a cleaning lady. Not that people, you know, I'm not making this a sexist thing.
Average people do not have cleaning ladies.
I'm saying you maybe do.
They don't have Sundays to rest either.
Well, okay, that's what I'm saying is a lot of stuff now, a lot of people now will have somebody to cut the grass, maybe. If all of a sudden on Saturday you do all the stuff you're supposed to do during the week with your kids and so forth. I'm saying all this other stuff plays into it, correct? If somebody is not at home, child care is the biggest one. Child care is a job, okay? Normally it's, I won't say normally, historically done by the female, but sometimes the male. But it is a job that's never counted, correct?
Correct.
That's all I'm saying. I'm not against sexist count. I know a lot of families where the guy stays home, you know, and but... This is a lady's making a bunch of dough, but it's as a group, this is not how people are creating wealth. Is what I'm saying. That's kind of the theme here.
Yeah,
and I, you know, that's different in the last 40 years, and I think it's not healthy, Kevin, in the long run.
Well, it isn't, and I think that, you know, the issue that you run into is exactly what you're saying, is there's the second income it loses a big chunk of it to other factors. So second incomes work great if you don't have any kids.
Right.
That's fantastic. That's totally additive. When the kids get older, and there are a lot of those, a lot where one spouse, like you said, usually the woman will stay out of the workforce until the kids are old enough to come home from school and take care of themselves, generally junior high age. And they're also old enough to come home and get in a whole lot of trouble at junior high age.
Yeah.
But that's part of it. But you're not incurring direct child care expenses at that point. Nevertheless, it is expensive to... there's some extra cost, no matter what, when you have a family, of having one parent out of the house. There's always something, whether it's going to cut 10% out of the salary or 50% out of the salary, that's the debate. And the only reason you would do it on the 50% thing is that you're trying to build a career that later, when the kids are older, you can really pursue your career in earnest. It's just to stay in the game as much as anything, because it definitely is not adding. Otherwise, where you're seeing families do that then is you're starting to see a lot more, well, we have to work different shifts, we have to work different days wherever possible, and that's hard. That's hard on a marriage, and anything that's hard on a marriage is hard on a family.
Oh, yeah, I guess, Kevin, if you're living in a one-bedroom apartment like I used to in the near north area, and you marry somebody, and she moves in and says, "Oh, don't worry, I only need half the closet," you know, and we'll just live here for the next 5 years.
That no one ever.
Yeah, you know, it's if that happens and you just double your salary, then yes, you can. You, all of a sudden, you can do really well with two people living in that same apartment, and blah blah blah. But there's still one car. But all of a sudden, somebody wants another car, or you know, and the expenses just keep. Yesterday, I go to the parking lot. I see this thing on my windshield. I go, okay, what the hell is this? Well, you know, your mayor has raised all the parking tax fees. Your parking's going up next month. It is relentless, Kevin. It's relentless. Now, that's not in the CPI anymore, is it? I think I know. So the constant.
So you're saying we make policy decisions based on incomplete numbers?
We don't want to know the numbers.
I'm totally shocked by that.
Yeah, we don't want to know the numbers. Why let the facts get in the way of a good story?
Numbers? We don't need no stinking numbers.
No. It's interesting.
It's incomplete, and that's always dangerous. And that's always a danger, no matter what numbers you have. It is. It's the unknowables that'll get you every time. And that's always true. But you take as much data as you can. And then it's not just the data either. You know, we talk about this all the time. It's taking data, turning it into information, looking at trends. So when you guys go over the employment numbers next week, what you're going to talk about the data a little bit, but the beautiful thing is that when you start looking at the unadjusted numbers and comparing them to prior years, what's the expression I've heard? Oh, I don't know. One somewhere between 1 and 500 times on this show, Christmas comes the same time every year. So you know, you can start doing a comparison here that and get some understanding in it, and that's really turning it into information. Unfortunately, at least for public consumption, all we ever see is data. It's raw numbers. It's not sliced and diced. It's not put into any time series. It's not well understood. And that's exactly what we saw to manipulate the population and keep everybody scared with COVID. How many cases do we have? What's the biggest, scariest number? Oh, we crossed over 500,000. We crossed over 1 million this week. You know, those kinds of things. How many people are dead? Well, we just had our 600,000th death. You know, this kind of stuff where when you start to look at it, you say, well, what's the fatality rate? Oh, I don't know, less than 0.5%. That might be a little more interesting than the big, scary number. When you start to say, what is it by age group or by comorbidities and so on? What's the effect? Big, scary number. Well, then what happens? We work on big, scary numbers. What kind of dumbass policies did we get out of that?
I ask a question, Kevin. When that happens, and I remember some specific stuff because I was driving around. I was listening to a Pritzker news conference, and how much? I'm gonna try and be nice here, but I'm probably trying to be nice, but trying to be nice. As I saw the thing, it happened originally awful fast. Nobody really knew what the hell they had. Well, maybe some people did, and they weren't saying. But the rest of us didn't know what kind of tiger.
Don't
we
tell
had.
Me they weren't saying. They weren't allowed to say.
Okay, but I'm talking about week one, when you're hearing these absolute horror stories about people coming back to Milan, because the Milan and the Wuhan province are people flying back all the time because all the high-end fashion is in Milan, evidently, and there's a massive flow of people back and forth. Well, Milan gets hurt horribly. The people that came from the Boston Scientific Conference in Europe, and some of those people, they had a big conference here in Boston, and how some of the people evidently at that conference were, what do they call them, master spreaders or something. It was a pretty messed up disease in terms of some people could, infected people, what was the final stuff we read that something like, they think all the people of COVID, some huge percentage, like 85% of the people infected were infected by 15% of the people who had it. Some people just had massive amounts of this germ. Anyway, but it looked pretty bad when it started. Okay, so the idea that we're going to shut down for a week or two and figure out what the hell we have. I'm not so sure that I would was so far again that, you know, or something along those lines. But
okay, so you could salute 15 days to flatten the curve.
Yes.
Unfortunately, 15 days was more like 15 months.
Well, but what I'm saying is now stuff starts to happen. In the political world, the press, and by the way, the two guys were on yesterday, did nothing but excoriate the press, which I thought was pretty interesting, since they're both kind of in that business, Wayne and Andrew. Now all of a sudden you've got this stuff happening, and somebody who said we're going to shut down, all of a sudden, the decision to turn that around, part of it is, I'm used to saying, hey, I bought XYZ and it's down, I made a mistake, next time I'll sell it, you know, it's in my DNA being a trader. I'm not afraid to admit a mistake. I did the best thing I did when I made the decision. I'm not afraid to make a decision. If I'm wrong, I'll fix it the best I can and move on to the next one. But that's sort of not in the political landscape, because people keep, what's the word they use when you change your mind politically? You're a
flip-flopper.
Yeah. I mean, so all of a sudden, you shut restaurants down, but to me, a month later, I'm driving by Walmart and they're selling hot dogs. The guy across the street's closed. I'm going, wait, what am I doing here? This makes no sense, you know, type of thing. You would think that people had the ability. How much of the inability to, I'll use one of your terms, adjust on the fly, was stopped by the fact that the press was sniping at everybody who changed their mind every single day? Is it just lack of backbone? Is it lack of knowledge? Is it lack of, what is it? I mean, I don't know. I'm asking.
Okay, but also, how much of that policy was because we did not tolerate dissent, because we had all kinds of evidence right in front of us? You know, for example, let's just talk about policy as it relates to elder care. And we knew, like in March of 2020, we knew what happened in Kirkland, Washington with that senior living facility, and yet they continued to pour people in there. It's because it's stupid. I don't know a better way to say it. We have people who just made stupid decisions, not uninformed decisions, not overly cautious decisions, that despite the best evidence, they made stupid decisions. We have history on attempting lockdowns. Didn't work in the past. We had history on mask wearing in public. Didn't work in the past. We had history unfolding in front of us, showing us that mask wearing didn't work, that there was no effect in places that mandated them versus places that didn't, and yet they still did mandates. This is just people ignoring evidence and proceeding to just be stupid. Whether it's for control, I don't know how much of the policy that came out of the government health agencies was just Fauci covering his ass. I don't know, but I do know that we had people, and we talked about it nonstop on this show. I know you try to be as understanding as you can, but I don't understand a lot of it because this is just people ignoring evidence and making stupid decisions anyway. And we see that in the business world all the time.
Well, I don't think I ever.
We see people who don't understand data all the time. You know, I talk to all of my students and said we're working on our stats for quality management, and I remind them that your plant manager is going to come down and ask you why your scrap rate was above average this last day, and you are going to have to boldly look at your plant manager and say, because that's how averages are calculated. Sometimes you're above and sometimes you're below. That's math.
Well, I'm telling you, I use the term that I understood. I'll always understand the initially maybe poor decisions after they're looked at later. I never understood the lack of continual review of those decisions and the strength and ability to change them as we went along. I never understood that.
I agree with you, Tom. So, yeah, people are afraid. They're afraid to make a wrong decision. Okay, I can get all of that. But you're right. The ability to just make a decision and say, well, now I'm going to stick with it. I'm not even going to review data anymore. I'm just going to go, that's just stupid.
Well, I agree.
I'm not willing to say it's uninformed or anything else. I'm not willing to come up with a nicety for it. It was stupid.
Well, I guess, as usual, I'm doing the absolute long... want to tell a long story, don't tell it. And I'm not beginning to say anything about this air crash or anything, is there, through our education system now, and maybe the fact that there's a lot of single parent homes, there's a lot of stuff, are the people that are growing up today, I'm not going to take a shot at the younger generation because I think they're actually pretty good, but the ability to solve those kinds of problems is kind of a total different thing than school learning. It could be the same, but sometimes it's not. Are we just have an awful lot of people in charge that when they're lobbed a problem, they're in a position where they're supposed to be able to solve it, and they just can't? I mean, politicians, clearly, if you drop a world war on most presidents, I'm not just saying about Trump, you're not ready for that, neither would I, right? I mean, but some people have the ability to wrap people around them, learn as they go, figure out the things they have to learn first. There's a problem-solving mystique that sort of came out of, the World War II dads that I think has been missing for a while because they're gone. I mean, some of the guys that have been the producers on the show, not Ricky, but like Manny Weber, Manny's one of the greatest guys I've ever met. We're playing softball, he goes, Chief, and he moved upstairs in my building. He goes, anything that guys are supposed to be able to do, I can't do. You're going to have to show me. Because he came from a single home. The thought of, we're going to go out and fix the tire on the car, here's how you do it. I don't think people realize how much of an education you get by doing that. You do this first, you do this second, and oh, by the way, you test it, and if it still leaks, we'll be able to go back and do something. That whole sort of mentality seems to be missing at every level of government in the COVID situation to me. And I'm not so sure it's back now with what we're doing all this stuff.
It's missing in all kinds of other areas of government as well. I've been on the show. I've been on the risk assessment bandwagon, and you can do it lots of different ways. I think people in manufacturing, at least if they're manufacturing the kinds of things that, where people can get hurt if it fails, they understand it. They do what are called FMEAs, which is failure mode and effects analysis. So, they understand looking at that. But if you really... I'll go back to raising teenagers. If you sit down with your teenagers, or whenever you can, I used to talk to the kids in the car because they didn't have cell phones then, and so it got their undivided attention.
You had a captive
audience. And we could talk about all kinds of scenarios, because if they had thought about things ahead of time, they at least have a decent chance of getting it right. Different situations that can get them in trouble. Whereas, if they haven't thought about it ahead of time and they have to make it up in real time, you have a much higher probability of getting it wrong. And that's the same thing with the pandemic, different unfolding scenarios in the world. Can you think of everything? No. Can you think of a lot of things that are at least related to the subject matter? A lot more, yeah. And so the preparation for these jobs, for these policy-making jobs, and this goes back to what, the DEI discussion. The preparation for that job is not who you are, it's not what you are, it's who you are, it's what you know, it's what you know how to do. And those kinds of things, the preparation for that job is that you learn to assess risks, and then you either act to prevent something from happening, if possible, or you have a plan to react to deal with a situation if you can't prevent it. That's pretty common stuff, and that's not evident in the way the administrative parts of our government operate.
No, I remember the one press conference, and I've mentioned this before, and probably never mentioned it again, but I was listening and coming home from Audrey's on a Sunday, and it's Pritzker had a press conference on a Sunday. Why he was doing that, I don't know. But I don't know who was in it seemed like all the questions were coming from ladies. There might have been one from a guy in there. That's just the fact. That's not an assessment of anything. The governor of Michigan had just done something I thought was like incredibly stupid. It was a total mask mandate or everybody out of school. It was something that was like the extreme end of this thing. And Pritzker's saying, well, we don't think we need to do that here. We're going to wait and see if it's effective. And blah. The next four questions were just some diatribe about, you don't care if more people die in Illinois than die in Michigan. I mean, they were on this guy like white on rice. And as soon as I pull the car out of the garage, I go, I will bet anybody, any amount of money that I have, that tomorrow morning he changes the policy to one in Michigan, and sure he did. Why you'd set yourself up for that kind of abuse? You're going to kill people if you don't do this. I mean, it was brutal, Kevin. And, I guess the smartest thing would have never had a press conference, probably. But, I mean, to stand up to that when people are telling, if you don't do this and somebody dies, it's on you. I mean, that's a rough one.
Yeah, so my question is, how do you counter that? How do you deal with that? In that setting, because you have these great politician skills, and yet if you don't have command of the data, you have a really hard time being the great politician, don't you? What's your pushback is to lay out what the facts are, what's true. Who's really good at that? J.D. Vance is really good at that.
Some guys are good at it. They just deflect.
If you watch him doing sit-down interviews, there's a lot of people who say, why does he go talk to that particular media? And the answer is because he has his facts, and he is able to counter all the crap they throw at him. Whether you agree with him or not from a policy standpoint, it's rooted in an understanding of what's going on there. And he's really good at that. I don't know what else to tell you is, you have to have the confidence in yourself and the confidence in your command of the information that you can actually stand up to that kind of criticism, because otherwise you're going to get the shrill people, and someone's going to tell you, well, if one person dies, that's too many. And you can say, yeah, I agree with that. But, how can I, you tell me, how have we done so far in preventing that one person from dying?
I've found some people, and I don't know why I got to stop talking to people, but the cold-heartedness that seemingly has been unearthed in some people by the current policies, and I'm not going into the politics of it, but was it always there and just uncovered? It just was always. I mean, I saw a guy last night, and he's a really bright guy. I mean, he's an accountant, a CPA, all this kind of stuff, and does people's stay. And I said, this idea of dropping people in Guantanamo, I think we got to think on that one a little bit, because we're arresting people, and do we even really know? Are we charging them with a crime, or what are we doing? The guy goes, we're all criminals. And I said, well, okay, then, I guess you could go down that road. But I said, we do have people in Guantanamo now. And he goes, well, yeah, we should execute them or something. I said, well, the last time somebody was on the show, it's like 10 people there that maybe should be executed. There's probably 10 that are somewhere in the middle, and there's like 10 or 15 we know are innocent. I mean, we've known for 20 years are innocent, and they're still there. I said, we can't, nobody will let them up here. Nobody will take that arrow and say, hey, there's 20 people here that have no business in jail, never were. And by the way, we're gonna bring them to some town in Chicago. We're trying, get them a job or something. Oh, I don't want that. Why not? Well, because I don't want them here. We just said that they're innocent. Nobody didn't do anything. And I said the guys are in jail. He said, so what? It's better than their hometown. At least they're getting three hots and a cot. How can somebody say something like that, Kevin? What do you mean it's better than? How is being in jail better for anybody? It's like saying you did better off as a slave. No, you didn't. You were a slave. I mean, was this mentality, was it always in some people, and it's just now they can say it, or what?
Well, I'm sure with our access to all kinds of video and the ubiquitous news cycle and all that, I'm sure we're seeing stuff, a lot of stuff that was already there. But I also tend to think that we've become, in many ways, dumber over time. There are some people doing incredible things in all areas of development, of, you know, of business, of technology, and all things. And there's a lot of that, and it's very conspicuous. But I think we also raise a lot of idiots. I think we have a really crappy educational system that doesn't teach a lot of common sense, that doesn't, you know, that is overly political. Overly politicized, I think, is probably a good word for it. And so we are teaching what to think instead of how to think.
I look at my education was different. I was very similar to yours. I don't think I can remember a lot of grammar school. I can remember a lot of high school. There was no politics whatsoever. A little bit in high school. But it just was when people taught history, that, you know, they taught German history and Nazis and all that stuff, and they were quick to point out that if freedom was something, if you don't stay on it, people can drop into hating other people pretty quick, and it's something you always have to work on. I remember that. I remember them bringing a Palestinian dude in and talking about how, you know, that their family had to move a bunch of times before the Yom Kippur War, and the people got tired of moving because they kept expanding. I don't know if he's right or not, but it was a different point of view. So you got an idea that there's always two sides to every story. Now, you might decide you like one of them better than the other, but you at least should listen to both of them, right? If you're going to be any kind of a arbiter. I don't ever remember Republicans versus Democrats ever in the first 12 years. Notre Dame was that much, was pretty politically silent too, wasn't it?
If anything, it was conservative.
Yeah, well, I mean,
which it isn't now at all, but it was, it probably was more, tended to be more conservative at the time. I was in the business school, so I was going to get more conservative tilts anyway than most. But I went to a Jesuit high school, so social activism was encouraged. A lot of people doing marches, demonstrations, all that kind of stuff as part of school clubs. But you're right, when it came to going into the classroom, history could be slanted. Some of those, kind of things could be slanted, but honestly, if we were taking chemistry, we were taking chemistry. weren't worried about anything else. Biology, we were learning biology. That was it. Languages, etc. Nothing else really permeated the curriculum.
The only thing I'll say about Marist, they were to a man, the brothers were huge followers of Dr. Martin Luther King, and they. Yeah. They really thought that he was somebody very special, and we should listen to what he had to say. But other than that, that was probably the only, I learned a lot about what he was saying. That's when I was in high school. I mean, that was probably the only...
Among the Jesuits, I heard, a lot of people embracing Alinsky instead. That's Jesuits. That's what they do.
But I was... I don't know much about Alinsky's... We're talking about Saul Alinsky, who was one of the. He was, his big thing was the back of the yards movement, right? Went after the a lot of the place that worked in the yards, the stack yards, right? And I listened to him on a bunch of tapes and stuff, and I don't really know his politics so much, Kevin, but his knowledge of what it takes to change stuff I thought was spectacular. What percentage of the population did it take for this movement to occur? And he said it normally takes 7% of the population to make dutiful change. He said, but the Russian Revolution was less than 1%. Maybe because of the geography or what. He was always stunned at that. But he would talk, but I mean, I don't think any of the work he did at the back of the yards could be criticized. That place was the book, The Jungle. Those people beat the hell out of people, right? I mean,
Go look up Alinsky's Rules or Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. He wrote a whole book called Rules for Radicals, but look up the rules. And because when you look at those rules and then look at Obama, you will see that there was a whole lot of that incorporated into Obama's campaigns and his presidency. And you will see a certain amount of that through the Biden presidency, because there were so many Obama people in his, kind of behind the scenes in his administration, who embraced the tactics. And so you can decide that for back of the yards those tactics were appropriate, but you can also ask the question, are those tactics appropriate as a matter of public policy?
Yeah, I don't know. I would say probably. I'm not as up on those.
I would say no.
Whatever people had to do to get a union in the coal miners area, or how many people had to die in the Pullman riots, I guess it was worth it, because people looked pretty poorly, didn't they? I mean, you shouldn't have to do that every day, but that's what separates us apart from, a lot of other places. We, people in the middle class and lower class had some political power. Now maybe they don't anymore. But, we'll see. Hey, so you got a couple of minutes. What's the story of a girl at a big night again last night, Hidalgo, eh?
Yeah, she had 30 points last night.
Who's this girl who scored like 50 last night? Some game was just in some other, there's some lady in another game, not Notre Dame game, that she had 40 or 50 points, some kind of record?
Well, I'd have to look that up and see. If I were to guess, the most likely candidate would have been Juju Watson at Watkins at Southern Cal, who's a fantastic player too.
Are the ladies, is the Caitlin Clark phenomenon, I don't know if it's just that. I think a lot of the basketball is really pretty good. Are the attendances up for girls basketball, college girls basketball, across the board this year or no?
No, I not that I can tell. It's up. There's places where it's popular and there's places where it isn't. And I see that when I watch the Notre Dame women, because, for instance, last night they played at Virginia Tech, and Virginia Tech has had a very successful program and a great, great fan support all the time. And they probably get consistently, 7,000 to 8,000 out for their games, which is, pretty good. Now, they may jam the arena, completely. I probably can pull up the box score and see if I can find the actual attendance. Notre Dame sells out on occasion for women's, but for the most part, does really well. Stadium that holds a little over 9,000, they probably pull in 7,500 to 8,000 per game. So these are the things that you're looking at.
But that's way better than 5 or 6.
You go to Boston College and they're playing in front of friends and family.
But when you dragged me down there 10 years ago, they were nowhere near 7,500. It's way better than that now than it was then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and, but part of how they do it, too, is season tickets are cheap. I have season tickets. It's $150 a seat for the season.
Well,
pretty hard to top that for, entertainment.
You're going to have to pony up.
And they have a very entertaining team.
Well, you have to pony up a little more than that for your skybox seat at the Super Bowl.
I'm going to have to pony up that just to get 5 minutes of a hotel room there.
So if you get several seats down there, both Carl and I have nothing to do that day, that I know. If you want us down with you. Only the skybox.
That could be it. That could do it, yep.
Only the skybox. We're not going to sit with the rabble. Just saying.
Well, I'm not finding out who...
We'll worry about it next week. Have a nice weekend. Right. It's time for Carl. We're going to have a real quick break here. S&P futures up 25. NASDAQ futures up 155. That's because Apple's up 966. Microsoft's up 4. So those stocks have been going all over the place this week, but it looks like they're ending on somewhat of a high note. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks and Jocks. Josh.
Mark and Josh.
Stocks and Jocks.
You're out of control.
Right here. Hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Well, we're back at Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 24, and NASDAQ Futures up 152. I know Carl is long spoo. When are you going to sell him, Carl?
Oh, good God, no, I'm not long spoo. I have to say, since the election, I sort of here kind of wish I was, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, if you think about it.
Except we've been up 25% for 2 years in a row, so it's not just the election.
Well, I know. But, there's... So, I thought one of the most fascinating things, and I did a hour plus long podcast on it, and the RFK confirmation hearing, and then of course, as I'm recording that, unknown to me, we have a helicopter hit an airplane on them, on turning the final on at DCA. And then I'm sitting down here transcoding the thing because I've not done it live. I get better quality when I run to tape. So, if I run the recording, and that's just because the editing deck has some intelligence about it and can, especially with the audio, it does a better job than straight up compression. I mean, it's one of the things. I don't know if you've ever had any feedback from people that listen to the podcast or listen to the live stream that, there's times that the audio is not that great. Right, from either you or from someone else. Usually from the someone else, because you're in a studio, you got a microphone in your face, and we're on remote. Now, I happen to have...
Well, the Zoom is way better than the phones.
Oh, good God, yeah. But the qualitative difference when Zoom took over, which, was kind of a pandemic era thing when it really became a thing, right? Because people were using it professionally. It's huge. But even so, I did a podcast with the coffee and a mic guy, Michael Ferris, and he had all sorts of problems with the post-processing. He put it up anyway because, what was he going to do? Call back and say, hey, by the way, we need to reshoot this?
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there's... So I'm doing this, and the RFK thing, and then, and then Patel... Basically, all these so-called hearings in this series, and the same thing happened during Biden's administration. Okay, when he came in, because there's the dog and pony show, right?
It's free. It is free PR for all the people in the Congress.
Well, but you know what? There's I have a problem with this on both sides of the aisle. Okay, I don't care which one of these clown car brigade. I mean, there are times that I sit here in the chair and I say, if Vlad nuked the DC right now, I'd actually offer a toast. I wouldn't be angry with him. I wouldn't be rah rah go nail Russia right now, nuke Moscow. I'd be like, so what? Right? The world's a better place. And some of this stuff, I get it, that if someone has a legitimate concern that you're going to have someone who is just outrageously unqualified for the job, that's the point of advice and consent, right? Is you don't want that. I get that. I can make a clean argument that Buttigieg was one of those people. All right, he had zero relevant experience in field. He was a politician. He was a mayor. All right, he was a politician. He had absolutely zero relevant transportation experience.
How many people are you thinking? The Meta board here in Chicago have any transportation experience?
Well, Chief, I'm not saying that this is a unique problem across. It seems to be an issue no matter where you look in politics, right? But I get it that grilling people on things relevant to the job. I mean, that's what advice and consent is about. That's why it's there. It's why it exists. And so going after people on that basis is fine. But the stuff I saw with RFK and then Patel is outrageous.
See, I'm gonna disagree because not in general, but if like you say, the person for the Department of Transportation has no experience in there, and you can't grill them based on their experience and decisions they've made in that area before, all you're left with is the rest of the crap they said.
Well, yeah, I get that, okay? But this is, again, we're looking at a situation here. You know, what happened the other night is the latest in a long series of things that show what happens when you ignore safety critical systems and you deliberately circumvent the warnings that are there to prevent these kinds of things from happening, and you on purpose ignore them, right? I mean, Chernobyl happened this exact same way, and when you ignore them and you get away with it, it's 100 times worse, because every time that you have an alarm go off that is there for a good reason, you ignore it, you get away with it. What that does is reinforces and this is just a human psychology thing. It reinforces the idea that the bad thing, the guys that built that thing and put that safety system, they didn't really know what the hell they were talking about. That really wasn't necessary. By the way, it's all okay. It'll be fine. And, you know, Chernobyl, they were operating in a known unsafe part of the operating regime for that reactor. Okay, the RMBK reactor had a known issue with control rods being in certain positions, because if you had to shut them down rapidly, there's, as the reactor operates, xenon gas, which is a neutron poison, it absorbs neutrons and doesn't reflect them, builds up in the space where the rod was, physically, in the reactor, okay? If you shut it down very rapidly, in other words, you take a scram, a power line gets knocked down and all of a sudden the grid's unbalanced and you have to shut the plant down immediately, or, you know, a steam line breaks, or, you know, anything goes wrong that forces you to take the plant offline now, when you shove those rods in, the xenon gets forced out of the hole as the rod comes in, and for a very brief period of time until that rod gets in there, the power level goes up instead of down, which is what you're trying to do, is make the power level go down, okay? Well, it goes up instead. And this is a known design factor, and as a result, there are prohibited operating areas on those reactors. You cannot run in this zone of operation because it is unsafe, and they knew this. The Russians knew this, that were operating this thing. And several times they had been in this operating zone, they'd gotten a trip for whatever reason, the reactor scrams, and the instruments had recorded a bump in the power output, which is exactly what the system, you know, what the design engineer said was going to happen, but it didn't blow up. But the instruments did record.
Well, you would hope that there was some safety factor in there.
Well, but they were operating where they knew it was.
Yeah, I'm saying you're not supposed to constantly test the safety factor.
Well, but they had done it several times, Chief, and it had not exploded. Okay, and they had, you know, so they got very complacent about the idea that nothing bad would happen, right? Until the one day, it did.
Well, you know, the safety factors is, you know, I won't say people want to save money, but they do.
Right.
The overhead cranes at Pullman, they could pick up a whole car and pick over another car and drop it down. The overhead cranes, they could pick. We decided to go from a, I don't know, 5-ton crane to a 10-ton crane or something. And all we did was get all this new software or control systems. I said, what about the crane itself? The guy goes, what are you talking about? The actual crane, if it's a 10-ton crane, it's designed, it could do a one-time lift of 10 times that amount.
Right.
Then they went down to 5 times, now it's 2 times. So now you got to be, if you buy a new crane, you better be careful. These old ones, you don't be careful at all.
but you know what, this is, it's actually kind of funny that you bring that specific example up. So this is one of the things that has happened in virtually all industries, because we've got computer modeling now, and therefore engineering margins have been shaved because we have more precision.
Right. We think we do. Yeah.
Well, we think we do. But, it, you know, it's like when my I had a 45-foot boat, and the bottom of the hull was about an inch and a half thick, solid fiberglass. Okay? And I know that because I put a new transducer in it for fishing. The old one was of a different style and, you know, type, so I had to drill a new hole. Well, I mean, the core that came out of that thing was unbelievable. Holy crap! All right? And yet, if you look at today's boats that are built for the supposed same service, they're, you know, a third of that. And why? Well, because the when mine was built, there was no computer modeling, and so...
We'll tell you a lot of the difference between the bridges in New York and anywhere else.
Well, I'm just saying.
Yeah, they're overbuilt by a factor of three.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, the guys that built it were like, well, I know that's good enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to switch cameras here, but I got a good one for you.
I want to give you like the 15-second thing on this, right. Okay? So the DCA thing. 1 minute before, and Tom Massey came out with this video clip that's basically this is an outmoded display, which is what the ATC guy had on his screen, right? And I pointed out, I said, absolutely not. That is very 1 minute before the collision. It was very clear, showed the exact problem, that the helicopter was out of its flight envelope, outside of the path where it was supposed to be. It was too high. And it looks like horizontally it was outside of the corridor as well. That corridor is on the plates, on the sectionals. And the reason it's there is because if you fly within that corridor in the helo, you will be safely below a plane that is on pattern to land. All right? So 1 minute before the collision, and it's probably longer than that, but Massey only had a 1 minute clip. 1 minute before the collision, the altitude is too high, and horizontally he's outside. You know, whoever's flying the thing, there were two pilots in the chopper, but whoever's actually flying it is outside the corridor. Now, at that point, the plane that is on final, that is about to turn final and attempt to land on 33, at that instant, another aircraft in that immediate area has just taken the risk factor for the entire zone and made it unbounded. That's what's happened. Now, why the pilot is out of the corridor, I mean, the benign explanation is that person has lost situational awareness and doesn't know where the hell he is, right? Because you're not supposed to be there, right? So the benign explanation is whoever's flying that chopper has lost situational awareness and is unaware of the fact that they are out of the corridor that they are authorized to fly in. At that moment, there is only one sane thing you do, and this again goes back to failure analysis and how we get people killed all the damn time, and we need to stop this crap, and that is you wave off the plane that's lining up for 33, you tell him to go around because he obviously knows where he is, and the only way you can deconflict that successfully is he gets told to go around immediately. I don't care what the other explanations are, and then you solve the... Go chew the helo pilot's ass later. Right now, the problem is you've got an unbounded risk in that area, and you must clear it immediately. And they had 1 minute to do it and didn't do it, and that's why those people are dead.
Well, I watched a bunch of the tapes and everything, and I don't know about piloting as you do, but the... When the guy made the move to the other runway, it looks to me like he was right where he was supposed to be in the helicopter. I've read elsewhere, but in that area is supposed to be 200 feet. He was over 200 feet. I mean,
here's the thing: the altimeter read 1 minute before the crash. He was somewhere between 300 and 399 because the digits are only in the 100-foot resolution. Yeah. Okay. 1 minute before the crash, the helo's at 300, is showing a 3 for the altitude, and this is with that's 1 minute ahead of time. Plenty of time. He's out of the corridor, all right, and you've got an aircraft coming into land, and 20 seconds later, conflict alert comes up on the ATC scope, okay, which is the computer has determined that if those two aircraft continue on their current course, they're going to hit each other. And so 40 seconds before the collision, the conflict alert comes up. As soon as you detect that that guy's out of the corridor, you have to wave off the plane. Because he's on his flight plan. He knows where he is, and he is on, he is in the
approach. You should have the plane pull up.
Well, you have the plane go around. Okay? You have the plane go around. Because if you don't...
You mean turn immediately, not just...
He first has to power up. He has to establish a positive rate of climb and then turn. But there's a missed approach path that's always there when a plane is lining up for landing because you may miss the approach.
By the way, okay? I was on a plane that landed at National, and we had to do a go-around.
Well, when I was flying all the time for business, I was coming into Hartsfield down in Atlanta one time. We went around twice. All right. And after the second time, the pilot comes on the air, on the speaker, and he says, yeah, I know. I know that you recognize that we've gone around twice. He says, the reason we went around twice is that the first time, we were uncomfortable with the traffic separation. He says, the second time there was an actual plane on the runway we were going to land on top of.
Well, that's essentially what happened to us. So the guy who was in the window seat was the then vice chairman who was a pilot. And all of a sudden the guy, boy, those things can really power up.
When you hear the power come up, there's no question what happened.
Right? All of a sudden we go flying around and the guy says, well, the pilot comes out. Well, just to be safe, they gave us a... This guy's looking out the window. He goes, just to be safe, my ass, we were at the top of that guy.
Right.
he was taken off. He must have took off when he wasn't supposed to.
Well, but, I mean, that kind of thing happens. Is, you know, the controller says, you know, pull to this place and hold, right? And the pilot does not hold. He goes onto the active runway. And obviously, if you land on that runway, you're going to hit him. So, I mean, this was... But the thing is at the point that you know that someone that is in your control, your zone of control, which, you know, that's what the tower does, right? I mean, that's their job. Once you know that someone in your zone of control has lost situational awareness, why it's happened, sort that out later.
So you think the mistake was telling the helicopter to try and find a plane?
You know, you 1 minute before the collision, you're not having that conversation. The conversation is you get on it because there's only one safe action you can take. That guy doesn't know where he is, okay? So you tell him to do something. You have already you're issuing a command to somebody who doesn't have situational awareness.
You could tell him to go down.
He doesn't know where he is. He knows he's not supposed to be over 200 feet, and he is.
Yeah.
Okay, you don't issue the commands to him. You issue the commands to the person who you know is in control of his aircraft. He knows where it is, and he knows what he's doing. That's the guy you tell to deviate because he's the one who is going to follow the instructions. Deal with the reason the other guy's out of corridor later. Right now, what you have to do is make sure the two of them don't hit each other.
Yeah. Hey, before we're going to break, I want to ask you sort of the same question I asked Kevin regarding when we come to a fork in the road, let's take it. Seems like we've taken the fork in the road, and we're going to have some ridiculous PCE number come out. We're going to cheer, you know, some number that they conjured up. We're also cheering the hell out of Apple today because they said they raised prices.
Well, I realize that the PCE, you know, this is like the same thing. I was half my podcast the other night was basically a rant at all the people that were cheering these earnings reports that came out, right, from Apple and everybody else.
Well, they're good if they're your clients and they made money.
Well, hold on a minute now, Chief. The DeepSeek thing, okay, which is the disruptor, right, that everyone's been talking about, including me, happened after the close of the quarter. So you are reporting results from before the disruption, and everybody is rah rah rah. This says everything's great. What the hell it does? That's kind of like Thelma and Louise. It was fantastic 2 minutes ago before we gunned the throttle off the cliff.
Well, the incredible. What they used to say in the circling of the wagons that has taken place to defend the firms that have made these massive investments in the Navy and the government, basically saying, we're not going to let these guys come near our guys. And then the Navy said, banned it already? They don't even know what it is, and they banned it for a week, after 2 days? I mean, this is an amazing... what did the guy from Meta came out? And the stock's been up 2 days in a row.
I got to tell you this thing about the, you know, ban DeepSeek within, you know, within the Defense Department, you know, that happened. I know someone who used to work for DIA, and I guarantee you that would have not, absolutely nobody anywhere within the DOD would have ever been able to run anything against that system. Ever, period, whether it was publicly known or not, it would have been flagged instantly.
Well, that's what I'm saying. We're everybody's rising up and basically shoving the thing back. And I have no, I don't believe the Chinese.
It doesn't matter.
The fact is, appears to be a chink in the armor, and somebody somewhere, and maybe more than one somebody, might get you to somewhat the same place as AI, a lot cheaper and with a lot less power than they're currently doing, which is you've been talking about for 2 years.
Yeah, that's the issue, is that technology always does this, okay? But whether people in the U.S., people in the, you know, whatever part of the industrial technology complex, military, whatever, it makes no difference. These guys literally put a bullet in the head of everybody who was in the higher cost area because they released it as open source. Now, whether these guys did this because they, you know, they wanted to do it, did the Chinese government do it on purpose to torpedo the industry in the U.S.? It doesn't matter what the motivation was. If you're looking at this from a standpoint of operational things, the motivation is immaterial to the outcome. All right, because
now, if it's open source, I've had three or four people that, of course, listen to somebody on TV.
Right.
They said nobody's going to use it because they don't want all their stuff going back to the chains.
But it's open source, so it won't be. It's on your computer.
That's what I said. That my question to you, if you, I'm not saying you should go through a zillion lines of code, but if it was going back to the chains, could you find it in there?
Oh, it wouldn't be. If it was on my, I'm running on my computer, it wouldn't be going back to China. None of it would.
Okay, so how do you stop that from happening?
It doesn't happen in the first place.
Okay, explain.
The reason it goes back to China. The reason it goes back to China is because it's running on their computer in China.
Okay, so what's the difference between this stuff and the TikTok stuff everybody's pissed about?
Nothing. Which is the whole point. The argument that what I saw almost instantly when this thing broke was, well, every keystroke that you put in is going to China. Of course it is. The computer is in China.
Yeah.
Okay. Duh. By the way, what do you think the issue was with TikTok? All the data is going to China because it's being processed in China. Okay. Duh. All right. What one of my problems with, like, for example...
Hey, stupid question. How does that get there? Like, satellite?
No, it's mostly undersea cables these days.
Okay, undersea cables.
And the reason is that the undersea cable's faster. Okay, that's why. It's faster and cheaper, therefore that's typically how it's done. I mean, can you use satellite? Yes. Satellite's slower and more expensive, so why would you? That's kind of stupid. Undersea cables have essentially, the fiber optic ones anyway, have essentially ruined any other model anywhere where they happen to go.
Well, I know we did that back and forth in the Atlantic for like 100 years, but I didn't know we had so many in the Pacific.
They're all over the place. They're in the Pacific as well.
Well, that's a big jab. Pacific's a long way.
And they're also very easy to find, so if we ever really get into a shooting war, they're one of the first things, you know, you've probably read the articles that some of these things have been allegedly sabotaged by, you know, by the Chinese or by the Russians or whatever have you, you know, the Baltics and all of this. And one of the reasons that is not hard to do is that every couple of kilometers you have to have a repeater. So the cable itself, while it is fiber optic, and fiber, of course, doesn't emit anything that you can detect, you have to have a repeater every so often for that laser signal that goes down the cable. And that requires power.
And as a result of that, the cable has power leads in it, and that's detectable.
Where do you get the power in the middle of the ocean?
All the way down from one end and the other.
I mean, it goes all the way down the line?
It absolutely does.
Well, that has to be copper then, right?
Well, yeah. But it's inside the jacket. So, I mean, you have the, you know, you have the actual fiber.
How big around is this thing?
Oh, with the armor on it, pretty decent size. I mean, not huge, but pretty decent size.
So you just lay it down there, wherever it lands and drops on some.
Well, they use soundings, they use sonar to place it originally. I mean, obviously you don't want it to, you don't want to drop it into a place where it crosses a trench that has no support and, things like that, right? I mean, there is a strategy to how this is done. They're not stupid. You can buy towed sonar stuff for recreational vessels, which is, or just have one that, is mounted on the bottom of your boat. I have one. I use it to find fish, but it also finds the bottom. And so contour mapping the bottom is basically, you do
now,
that.
If I was representing the fish union, I'd say those things should be illegal.
Well, maybe, but it certainly helps me, right? Because I want to know where the fish. If you put your line down in the water, there's no fish. You just wasted your time, right?
SP Futures up 27. NASDAQ Futures up 162. We'll go to a quick break. Be right back. Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons: new technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher. It may not. It could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains, think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe think about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the Interactive Broker high-end platform. There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to access Dan Janitas at Creditas Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can, whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at tom@ptisecurities.com.
Stocks. Jocks.
Parks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Well, on Fed Station Jacks, I'm Tamar Ricky on the board. The PC number came out 0.3 versus expected 0.3. Well, I'm shocked at that. S&P was up 26, NASDAQ was up 154. We have Apple is the one that's up. It's up $10, 248. We've got Amazon up 229. Nvidia's actually down a little bit. Meta's up another 530. Real quick, over in Europe, Asia's kind of closed still for the... anyone of you two guys a year of a snake?
Well, no, but I went out running yesterday. Okay, first day in quite a long time that it was actually reasonable for me to run outdoors. Not yesterday, 2 days ago. And Garmin gives you these badges when you do things on certain days, right? If you record an activity on particular days, and I did not know I was going to get one for this. Right? I come in, I got a snake.
God. Well, DAX up 53.2%, FTSE up 29.3%, CAC around up 35.4%. So everything's pretty much up in Europe a little bit. Here we've got gold up a little bit. It's up like $6. So nothing crazy on this end except the earnings working their way through. And even if they come out and they're lousy, they come to the you got to buy the dip, it seems, with the earnings come out. And then all of a sudden when the somebody comes in, they talk it up, and off you go. And so it's a kind of a crazy world with that. Ricky, what do you have for us, Trader Radio Sports?
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:34 a.m. here in Chicago. 37 degrees right now with a high of 38. Dense fog this morning and increasing winds and rain colder this afternoon. There can be pounding on streets and highways, so beware of that. Tonight will be windy and mostly cloudy with a low of 29 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 43 degrees right now with a high of 67. Sunny most of the time, and tonight will be clear to partly cloudy and chilly. Traffic in Chicago, inbound heading from Melrose, looking at 60 minutes, 30 minutes heading from Lane Cook, inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 25 minutes, inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, another 25 minutes, and lastly, Stevenson from 24th to Dan Ryan, 27 minutes. Let's talk about sports. Yesterday, the Blackhawks lost to Hurricanes 2-3. We got the Pro Bowl game coming this Sunday, February the 2nd, at 2 p.m. at Camping World Stadium in Orlando, Florida. And finally, we got today a couple NBA games, Bulls at Raptors at 6:30 p.m. and Suns at Warriors at 9 p.m. Back over to you guys.
So, Carl, when's Ricky going to do an Angelica on the Hawks that she did on the Bulls, where Bulls lose to Pistons, who cares, all they do is lose?
Well, you know, there's the choke factor. You know, I was in Chicago when I was running my internet company in the 90s. That was the Pippen Rodman Jordan triumvirate, right?
Yeah. Which Tony Kukoc and some other people, yeah.
Well, but that was a good time to be a Bulls fan, right? I mean, on the other hand, the Bears, well, they were more like the Cubs that got mauled every year by the Grizzly, right? So, then of course we had the Sox.
Yeah. Well, they somehow or other, they got that one World Series, which is still crazy.
Well, then you had the Flubs. I used to live right near there, near Wrigley, and I used to call them the Flubs all the time. And then that was supposedly because of the curse that was laid on them by the Billy Goat guy.
They wouldn't let them bring the goat into the park.
Right, and so he cursed the team, but of course they broke that eventually, right? And they won. Some of it's all good fun. Some of it's just, I got to have an excuse for why I suck at playing whatever it is, or doing whatever it is.
In immortal words of Jack Brickhouse, anybody can have a bad century.
That's true. I think one of the things that I just found, astonishing, like with this whole thing in the market lately, is that this is the same sort of crap that I saw when, in 07 when we had the two hedge funds, the two little Bear Stearns hedge funds that blew up, and the same kind of whistling past the graveyard that I saw in 1998, and in 1998, and then 99. All through 99, I was being mocked mercilessly by everyone that I knew in the technology field because I had, I'd sold my company. I decided not to IPO it. There were a lot of personal reasons behind my decision as well. It wasn't just market conditions, but it was, it's like most decisions. It's not one thing that leads you to make a decision. It's when you look at everything in context. That looks to you to be the right call, right? Sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. That's the thing about being a trader. Or having any kind of transactional mentality, and if you're in business, you better have a transactional mentality of things. But then, of course, we know what happened in the early part of 2000, and I continue to believe that there is no way that with these valuations, you were talking about it earlier on the show this morning, right? The average, the median income versus median home prices, right?
Yep.
And I'm seeing the screaming now of people that have the short-term rental stuff around here. And I warned everybody, including the county commission. I took my 3 minutes and used part of it to address them on this. Because, of course, they were giddy beyond words at all the tax revenue that they were making from everybody coming here because everyone else was shut down. Basic supply and demand is not a set of suggestions when it comes to economics, right? And so you have, you take two-thirds of the supply of rental cabins off the market for a period of time because there's nothing to do there, so no one's going to come. And yet here,
where we were in Tennessee, everything was open, so you could come here, and gee, what's that do to price, right?
Yep.
Well, it did exactly what you would expect it to do to price. But I stood up and I said, look, you folks need to understand this is a temporary situation. These areas are not going to stay closed forever. They will reopen. I don't know exactly when they will, but this too shall pass. We're not all going to be dead. When it reopens, all of that supply is going to come back on the market because the places did not burn down. They're not destroyed. They're going to show they're still there. When it comes back on the market, you're not going to get these prices. And as a result, you're not going to get this tax revenue. It's just not going to be there because of, you're going to go back to something that was more akin to what it was in, like 2019. And that's what's now happened. And now everybody is, oh my God, I can't, I paid this much for this and, for this place. And I've got four bookings in the entire month of March. Well, yeah, you have four bookings because you're priced like it was 2021. And there was a third of the supply available because we were the only ones open within a three-state area. Now they're all open. And Chief, this also goes to what I've said about this whole situation with the illegal immigrants and the migrants and all of this. The data is that only 5% of those people that came in here under Biden's authorities were those guys that were over at Home Depot trying to get work and were working. Okay, the rest of them were not. Well, but what they were doing was consuming resources, including rental housing, and now we're going to destroy that demand. And, Trump is doing that. By the way, should have been, this should have never happened, but you're going to get the realignment. When you take the demand off, what happens? Well, price goes down. Now, on the other side, all of a sudden, we've got all these construction sites that seem to be empty because all labor was illegal immigrants, right?
Well, all right. That's a problem.
Well, except, is it really? No. There are plenty of people who can do that work that are Americans.
They historically, for some reason, do not want to.
It's not that they don't want to. It's that they won't for $6 an hour. Okay? Now, what's that going to do? Well, that's going to increase the cost of the labor. All right. So now, if I'm an American and I have had trouble finding work, I win twice by this. Number one, my wages go up. Number two, my cost of housing goes down.
When I first moved into the hood I live now, a few years after I'm in there, all of a sudden everybody in a block, for whatever reason, maybe one person does it and everybody else decides to do it, everybody starts doing this remodeling, right?
Yeah.
And they've got virtually all, you don't see this today, but it's the same issue, although we don't, they're not, they look more like we do. All these guys are Russian.
Yep.
Most of them don't speak English, and all of a sudden one day I'm talking to one of the guys. Imagine that. Kind of me talking to somebody. One of the guys that spoke English, and this is when everybody's complaining about, the people that are working on these projects are not Americans. And the guy says, you know what? I'm from Russia. I don't have my citizenship yet. He said, I'm not doing this cheap. He goes, I'm doing union wages. I'm $35 an hour, whatever it is. And he says, I don't see anybody here who wants this job. Nobody's coming from the west side, the south side, and nobody's pouring out of some high rise where the kids have much ado saying, I'm going to go put in a kitchen for 2 weeks and make some money. They want no part of this. He goes, and everybody's bitching at me. He says, you know what I'm doing? I'm going to London. They're paying $50 an hour, and they're nowhere near as abusive, yet they don't want to be here. It's not like they showed up and said, these are our jobs. We've never seen anybody else here. Nobody wants
it. Here's the thing about that, Chief. I've several friends that do fairly high-end work in some of the construction around here and have, that's how they've made their money for quite a long time, okay? They're having when it looked like Trump was going to win, and with the state, Tennessee has last year, it was the last session around, the last legislative session before the presidential election.
they passed a law that prohibited local and county and state law enforcement people from withholding immigration status data from the federal government. Okay, now there in this area, there hadn't been all that much of that kind of thing going on with the illegals driving with, you know, with no license and no insurance and getting away with it. Because they would throw you a button for jail whether you were an illegal immigrant or not. Just hit that. They didn't care. You're supposed to have a driver's license. You're supposed to have insurance. You're going to jail. By the way, you can talk to the judge about how you're going to pay for the car that you destroyed when you hit that guy. But in a lot of parts of the state, that it was wink, wink, nod, nod, just like it is in Chicago and many other areas. And so, and in fact, where I used to live in Florida, I had a friend of mine that got rear-ended by an illegal immigrant that had no license, no insurance, and clearly the other person's fault because
there were large chunks of the city where everybody's a citizen and nobody has insurance.
Well, in Michigan, Michigan is even worse because Michigan, as a result of the no-fault law that they passed in, and that was when I was growing up, that happened, and as a result, the medical cartel wildly violates 15 U.S.C., and of course, since we don't lock anybody up, we don't throw anyone in jail, what was supposed to solve a problem with the ambulance chasing and the crazy lawsuits, oh my neck, when there really isn't anything wrong, that all that stuff. What actually happened is that let's say that you get in a car accident in Michigan, and your knee's screwed up because you got a car accident, right? And so you go to get an MRI done. Well, the same MRI, if you injured your knee because you slipped and fell walking your dog, is three times as expensive as if you were in a car accident.
Well,
now you would think that the first time that some medical provider got caught doing that, the handcuffs would come out, but of course they don't.
No, well, we used to have you had to be insured in the state or have a $10,000 bond. That was so unenforceable. I think they changed it. But you mentioned that you've been out of Chicago a while. We're getting labor here to do anything. I know some people here that are Hispanic, and they're regular, they're citizens and all that stuff.
Right.
They know a lot of people that work in these landscaping companies and stuff. And the first thought you have is the guy's paying them nothing and they're all illegal. And one of the guys in the building, his brother-in-law owns a place. He goes, $25-$30 an hour is the minimum. Nobody will work for less than that.
That's because the cost of living has gone up so high.
Well, but it's also that's what happened to a lot of your restaurants, because restaurants would pay way less, and all of a sudden when they were closed, and everybody got a job for like twice the amount of money.
Well, why would you go back to the job that pays half as much?
I don't think Chicago might have some illegal people working, but I don't think they're working for nothing. It's pretty competitive here.
Oh yeah, but again, the laws of supply and demand are not suggestions; they're absolutes.
Speaking of which, I didn't listen to Lagarde. I've been trying to listen to her on this ECB thing here.
Oh my God!
I've got the ECB money supply going up. I got ours is like 5.7, 5.5, which is not fighting inflation. All theirs, I think, is closer to 7.
Yeah.
Now, they came out with this dovish tone today, which has made our market, stay up here. Are either of those people, her or Powell, do they even think they're in charge? I listened to that guy talk. He's not in charge of the St. Patrick's Day parade in a one-car town. Does he have any idea what's going on?
Chief, as I have pointed out for 30-plus years, okay, all the way back to the 1990s when I used to I obviously had a reason to pay attention to all the macroeconomic stuff because anybody's running a business, you'd better the biggest weapon the Federal Reserve and any central bank has is their mouth, and they use it repeatedly, and one of the biggest problems we have as a society, and it's not just in the area of monetary policy, it's in all areas, is that the press laps up whatever crap gets spewed by the politician of the day-to-day, whether it be Powell, whether it be Trump, whether it be Biden, whether it be, you know, whoever, right? And has a headline pre-written out to fit whatever narrative they're running. I mean, you saw this on display during these confirmation hearings. There were a couple of people, you know, they hand out, there's only a limited number of seats in those hearing rooms. I've shown up, and you know, if it's not a busy thing and nothing of special interest, you can just more or less get a ticket to get into any of them, because they are public, all right? Now, you know, nowadays...
Yeah, but how public is the Capitol? You used to be able to walk right in.
Post 9/11, it's a pain in the ass. Prior to that, you literally could just walk in the door.
I mean, we had a... I'm trying to recollect. We did a couple of, you know, booze and hors d'oeuvre things up on the Capitol for some people, and I don't even know if I needed a name tag. I need a name tag for the... We'd have one on for a party, but...
Oh, no!
I just walked right in the building.
No, Chief, well, before 9/11, I did some personal lobbying work there, okay? Took a couple of trips over there to, you know, to talk to representatives and senators on things that I wanted to discuss. And, there was a magnetometer at the door, okay? You know, you're not going to walk in with a gun, yeah. Right?
But, you know, sure that in 1998 you even had that.
There was one... At the entrance to the rotunda, at the doors to the rotunda.
But we always went like a side one where all the like the.
Yeah, but going into like the House and Senate office buildings, like into the Hart office building or Rayburn or whatever. No, you just walked in. I mean, there was a cop there, but you know, yeah, okay, and. I mean, but there was none of this, you know, TSA kind of you know, experience. Now you have to go through a visitor's center to get into the Capitol entirely, and you know, there is none of this wander the halls of Congress. You used to be able to do it without any question at all.
Yeah, the question is if all the security, has they actually saved anything?
Oh, well, they made a lot of money for the people that built the thing and, you know, and staff it. I mean, it's like anything else in government, right? The TSA... Yeah, the TSA was not there because people brought something they weren't supposed to have on those planes on 9/11. Box cutters were not prohibited. I used to fly around with all kinds of tools because I did diagnostic work and installations and highly technical stuff. And some of those things are kind of sharp, right? I mean, you know, the pick that you use to pull chips out of a board, that's a hell of a weapon if you decided to use it. It's really, I mean, it's very sharp. So, I mean, you know, there you go. But, the thing is, though, is that you look at this at like these hearings, and if you have one of those tickets, people have been posting pictures. Before the hearing has started, you have the press representatives from CNN and Fox and, you know, C-SPAN, whatever. They've already got the headline written. They already got the article that they're going to send from the hearing room. And the hearing hasn't started yet. So they don't even know what the person's going to say because they don't even have the opening statements and they obviously don't have the questions because they haven't been asked. And yet, the news story they're going to file is already written.
Yeah, I find it...
That's nuts.
It's nuts.
It's nuts. But this is, I mean, you know, now, that was the case, by the way, back... You know, before 9/11, when you could wander freely through. The only thing is, we didn't all have phones in our pocket with cameras, so you saw it if you ever went into one of those hearing rooms and you sat in the back because the press guys are in the front. You could see it on their laptop, but you had no good way to, you know, to prove it to somebody. You say, "Well, I saw it." Oh yeah, you're lying. No, I'm not. I saw it. Well, you know, all right, proof. You don't got it. Now everybody's got it.
But the things that we're seeing that I continue to see, I mean, we're much better at it than we were in the 1980s and other places, is this is working out so well for some group of society. And by the way, my clients, too. So fine. It's working out so swell. We're just going to start it up all over again. We're going to keep doing this. And one group is going to fall behind, like we talked about in the first hour, one huge group. The other group is just going to... But how much, with the valuations, how much can you push society apart to where, at the end of the day, those are the people that are buying the Teslas? And if they don't have any money...
Well, that's exactly the problem, right? Is that, first off, if you're a business person, and this is... I don't know how many times I've told people this. If you think I would have sat there and told half the population of Chicago to go stick it because of their political beliefs, you're out of your effing mind. The only color I saw when it came to, the way that I ran MCS was green. Do you have some?
Yeah.
You know, fork it over, here's your service. Everybody gets treated exactly the same. And I made, even during that time, Chief, I had plenty of people all over the political aisle, all right? And I mean, we were the, it's like any other business, you're the microcosm of the employment pool you draw from, right? I mean, I had a lot of college students that were working.
Well, Chicago was much more vibrant when you were here. The exchanges were here and all kinds of stuff.
Well, that's true, but you know what? We had plenty of people with the precursor to the green hair thing. All right, I mean, one of my customer service agents was a flaming gay man. All right, I mean, it was every color of the rainbow was in my office. All right,
well,
that was the employment pool that you drew from. So if you hire based on merit and you're not discriminating, you're going to end up with something that looks kind of like what the people look like, right? I mean, that's... hello.
Well, I mean, you should be hiring people if you just hire the best person, you should end up with somewhat of a diverse crew after a while.
Well, that's exactly what I just said, is that, yeah, I mean, you hire the best person out of the group of people you have that present themselves that want the job during the time, right? And if you're not playing games... You ultimately end up with a crew that looks an awful lot like the population of the area that you're operating in, and that's just the way it is, And if there is segregation of that group of people by level of competence in a certain field or whatever, yeah, that's going to be reflected in your staff. But if not, for the particular job that you're doing. Customer service is not really all that complicated, right? I mean, you could train somebody to do that as long as they're literate and they're reasonably intelligent. You don't need rocket scientists to handle routine customer service stuff. You just don't. And out of there, some percentage of those people will end up floating to the top, get promoted, and end up in management roles. And who they're going to be? You'd love to be able to predict that in advance, but I got news for you. Some of the people that you think would be the least likely to end up in that situation, if you just strictly look at it on merit, they end up there. I had the person that ended up as my manager of customer service had a bare high school education and came to work for me as just a basic clerk, and yet she ended up in charge of that department because she put her nose down, she got the job done, and by God, she did it well. And that, over the space of a couple of years, the cream rises to the top.
Well, yeah, man, I mean, you and I have been, I'll freely admit it, we've been thinking that it couldn't go on this long, but
it has.
And it has, and I'm not so sure it's not going to go on for a while longer. And the longer it goes, the more concerned I am. I think that a couple of the checkpoints might be the 10-year rate over 5 or something along those lines, but it's not there yet.
It's a 4.5.
It's a 4.5. Nobody's afraid there.
Right,
I mean, I don't know. And it seems like people believe, the Bezos and the Zuckerbergs of the world more than they do the politicians. I mean, these are not stocks. These are religions.
One of the examples I keep using is you got companies like Costco, okay? Well, I mean, they're a retailer, for crying out loud.
They're very well run. They're double the PE the retailer's ever been.
Chief, they have a fantastic management team. It's proved in their operating results, but they're not expanding margins because you really can't in that field. What they're doing is opening more stores. Okay, so their operating income keeps going up because they site places and open more stores. This is what successful retailers do, right? I mean, that's how it works. And they've got a
a more than 10-year record of doing it really, really well. What the hell are they doing selling at 54 times earnings?
Well, that's right. My Home Depot's the other one. Because evidently they're going past from being retailers to being monopolies. I'm not saying that in a bad way, but it appears that in the short run anyway, if Costco has to raise prices, certainly membership dues, I just cut back from everybody to just one person. Right. My guys don't go there that much, so why am I paying for everybody?
Right.
So I mean, the fact that they can raise those things 10-15% or whatever it went up this year and was that much, and people buy it, they have pricing power. And whenever you go through this inflation stuff, like I used to study when I was in school many
somebody
years ago.
Somebody gets it.
So some people have pricing power and some people don't. And they may not even know that they have that power before it all starts, but all of a sudden they see everybody else raising their price 10% and it's gagging them. All of a sudden they raise their price 10% and their volume's down one or two. And they go, hey, this is kind of cool.
Right? Yeah, but you know, it's like, you know, the classical thing, though, that it you know, the Friedman ought to be rolling over in his grave of this stuff because, yeah. You know, when you look at this, one of the classical things that you learn in first economics class is that we really shouldn't need to have anti-monopoly laws. And the reason is somebody will always defect. You know, you get all 10 guys that sell carpet in an area and all agree.
I think you might not have to have cartel laws, but monopoly presupposes that the government gave it to them or they're somehow involved with them maintaining it. Once you do that, then you got a problem.
Well, exactly. And the thing, and it doesn't have to be an explicit grant either. All right. I mean, I look at what just happened with this AI thing with DeepSeek. And what I see there is proof just by the fact pattern that the corruption that has occurred as a result of grants out of the NSF and the academic world.
And the $1 million donations to the president personally,
$1 million donations to the president. The fact that we allow the NIH, for example, people that work there to get royalties from the drugs that get developed.
Yeah, we got a dish. I mean, having said that, though, I'm going to be fair. They gave all kinds of money to Obama and Biden too. So it's not.
Not saying it's. I'm pointing at all of them. I'm not pointing at one side or the other. All right. But the thing is that. You build this, it's soft corruption, but it's equally illegal.
Sure
it's just harder to trace, right?
It's actually more dangerous.
Well, it's much more dangerous because it's harder to detect and step on in advance. And yet, then you look at somebody, they come out and they say, we've got a solution to this problem that costs 3% of what everybody else has been charging.
Well, if you know, like I said, we're after our time here, but if... People are people, Carl. I mean, you're never going to change human nature, nor the property you want to.
It's 30 times the cost.
I'm saying at some point in World War II, I don't know, if you and I had the PT boat engine manufacturer guy, maybe we'd work a deal where we get 5% more than the world's best.
By the way, that was Detroit Diesel.
Okay, yeah. But I'm saying whoever it was, you know, but when the number gets to be like double or 50 and stuff, where you start changing where it's well beyond, you know, anything that's normal, we don't seem to have the common sense to catch that now.
Well, we don't have anybody that's willing to, you know, go stick a fork in the people doing it.
Well, it's, and you know what, the entire population has found out about that. Nobody stops at a red light, nobody stops at a stop sign.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you done skiing for the year, or are you going more time?
Oh no! There's at least one more significant trip that is on the menu, and it may end up it may interfere with the jobs report, but we'll see.
All right, I mean, next week. All right, well, we'll talk about it. We'll see you again on Tuesday. S&P was up 25.
Well,
S&P was up 151. We're riding this bull market. It's a lot of fun, isn't it? We'll be back on Monday. Thanks.
Yeah, here you go.
Yep.
That's all, folks.